When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, I'm Bex.
And I'm Laura.
And we're here to talk openly and honestly about miscarriage, stillbirth and all pregnancy loss.
We aim to smash the taboo surrounding these subjects.
And rebuild the topic in a way to support and educate women.
Rather than isolate and shame them.
Welcome
to the worst girl gang
ever. You tried it on with your neighbour?
No, he tried it on with me. Well,
oh, I see.
It was one of those real, like, I genuinely had my washing machine broke.
Okay.
And so genuinely, he came over to fix the washing machine, and then he turned out to be actually quite fit, and, like, I posted on Instagram, and people were very thirsty for him, because he was a good-looking lad. And we had a couple of drinks, and it was, like, he was very quite keen. And then it turns out he was 24. So
How old were you at the time?
31.
Okay, I mean, that's the exact age gap between me and my husband.
Yeah, the thing is, it's not the age gap, it's that I've been burned with that age category before.
Have you?
Quite severely. So my new rule is, like, can't go younger than 25.
Okay.
It's a self-imposed rule.
Also, surely, will that change year on year, or is that going to be forever? You can't go younger than 25.
Well, what's that? Isn't there is meant to be, like, one of those sort of rules where it's like half your age plus seven is, like, the limit of where you can go. So I will stick to that. But 20, also, the human brain, but particularly the male brain, is not even fully developed till 25. So, that's reason in and of itself, I think, to stay clear. Aww.
Age gaps are less significant the older you get, right?
My husband's 7 years younger than me. And to when we first started dating, it really bothered me because he's got a beard and I didn't realise how young he was. And then I was like, oh, my God, everyone's going to be looking at us like, And then actually, I don't really give a shit what anyone thinks anymore.
If I hadn't have had my, little heartbreak with my 23-year-old, when I was 29, so it's still 6 years, but I've just been so badly burnt that I vowed to my friends, I was like, I'm no longer going to.
And you think that was an age thing rather than just a I'm a dick thing?
I think it is. Some of it's an age, and I think he was young. Like, as he's an August baby. So, like, in the school year, he was, like, the young, really, really young. I think a lot of it was age-related.
He wasn't still at school, though. Can I just clarify?
He wasn't still at school. No, he wasn't still at school. I work in child exploitation. You can't come at me with these things. I will literally lose my job.
Okay, well, let's just say it was field experience.
Oh my God,
should we cut this? No, we're not cutting this.
You might think that you've joined a dating podcast at best.
At worst, something quite illegal.
Yes. But no, it is us. It is us, the worst.
It is I and them.
And she.
Okay. And they. Anyway.
Anywho.
So.
Yeah, we're here to talk about the older. The baby loss stuff.
Plus more.
So shall I do it?
You do it. I'm going to interrupt you though, so be prepared.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of The Worst Girl Gang Ever. We are joined in the studio by, now, hang on, your surname is different.
Ignore that. I am Laura Ann Bajet. That is my real name.
Okay. You use a pseudonym at work, do you?
Let's not announce the fact I'm using my work laptop for this. But yes, okay. I use a different name, partly because of Instagram, actually. This is my maiden name. So I use my maiden name for work, but my real legal official name is still L-A-B. And no one's ever called me that.
you can call me that if you want.
Laura B for us to have on this this series. And I'm also Laura B.
I mean, it's been a logistical organisational nightmare, if I'm honest, for me. Laura's sailed through, obviously.
Laura B,
yeah.
Yeah, so welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me. It does feel a bit like a long time coming.
It don't think I've ever called it a show before either. Jazz fans. Yes, it has been a long time coming. We were talking about having you on last year. Well, no, maybe longer.
It was. Last year, it was only a few weeks ago, so.
Yeah. No, I think you actually first messaged me just before I moved house. So that would have been like summer 2020. And I was like, oh, yeah, I should get the house out of the way. And that sounds great. And then, you know, life took a bit of an off-road. And then I think, again, last year, again, I wasn't quite in the place where I could do it. But now, third time's a charm. Third time
lucky.
And here you are.
Right from the very beginning, how did you become a fully-fledged member of the Worst Girl Gang Ever?
Way back when. So my life was pretty awesome. Just going to throw it out there. I'm not, you know, I had a pretty great life. Had it made, like graduated at 22. Bought my first house at 23 with my long-term boyfriend. Married at 24 and pregnant at 25. It was literally like a Disney film. It was like, you know, the dream. Which I will mention that again in a little bit, my magical Disney thinking and all the problems it's got me in. So I was pregnant at 25, first baby, really excited. And then at 23, 24 weeks, it all went to shit, basically. So we went for our anomaly scan at 20 weeks. Everything looked absolutely fine. Baby was just in an awkward position. My best friend's a midwife. So, you know, I told you, like mother, like child, obviously. So I had to go back again a couple of weeks later for a further, it was the heart. They couldn't quite get a visual on the heart. Yeah. So I came back again 2 weeks later. Again, couldn't really get the visual, but there was nothing to indicate it was a problem. It was just awkward baby. Went back again later that week, and that's when things started to change. We had to go down to Great Ormond Street because the obstetrician had seen something that he wasn't sure about. I mean, he was actually sure, but he couldn't say. So we went down to Great Ormond Street, and I remember the days are etched into my memory because I don't know if you guys remember, but the 26th of June 2015 was when there was that series of terrorist attacks. So there was the beach shooting in Tunisia and the suicide bombing in Kuwait. So we were in London, in Great Ormond Street, sat in this tiny little waiting room with sort of like paint. I remember it's like pastel coloured walls, sort of slightly vomiting inducing, watching on this tiny telly in the corner, watching all these like atrocities going on in the world. And I was like, it was a really hot day. It was really surreal. And I remember, again, my Disney thinking, turning to my husband, holding his hand and going, "Our baby's fine." And he was like grey. He was white. He said, "What do you mean?" I was like, "Our baby's fine." He said, "How can you say that?" And I was like, look what's happening in the world. Like, look at how, I was like, there's only so much shit can happen in one day. Like, there's devastation everywhere. I was like, "Our baby's fine." But I was wrong. So we went into to have the fetal echo scan and the doctor, I don't know what their job title was, I can't remember, but their doctor was like, we sat in this little room and they brought us this little counselling room. It was called like an interview room, and it had a box of tissues on the table, which is never a good sign, is it, when there's a box of tissues. And the nurse came and sat next to me. There's a cardiac nurse there, so she came and put her hand on my knee, and the doctor just said, "I'm really sorry, but your baby has hypoplastic left heart syndrome," which meant nothing to me. Yeah. But essentially what it means is on the kind of spectrum of like fetal or cardiac issues, you've got like a hole in the heart, which is kind of your lower level. Like some babies can even outgrow them, can't they? And then right at the end of the spectrum is hypoplastic left heart syndrome, which basically means the baby's got half a heart. And that was the beginning of my descent into the club, I suppose.
Oh, mate, horrendous. Yeah. So what did the next sort of few weeks look like for you?
Well, in the kind of immediate, in that actual conversation, the doctor was talking to us about this condition. I said, what are we going to do? And she said, well, most people with this faced with this diagnosis decide to terminate the pregnancy, which like that was a word that I just was like, sorry, what? Like, and I think I laughed because I was like, I must be being punked. Like, this is insane. I'm sorry, my dog is like, she's so totes emotional by the story. So she showed about termination. And I was like, that's not going to happen. We're not. And she tried to talk to me. I was like, I'm not interested in hearing about that. You know, obviously, we're not going to terminate the pregnancy. And she kind of went on to explain that, you know, that basically once baby was born, that, you know, the prognosis was really was not good. That he was fine. We didn't know he was a he, but the baby was fine whilst I was pregnant because I was doing the pumping the blood around for him. But once he was born, that would stop. And so she said, your options are either you terminate the pregnancy now, deliver early, which, you know, she said the other options that you can continue to term and deliver at term. she'd obviously, we wouldn't be able to intervene. So baby would be born, and then there's a little valve in the heart, which allowed, I don't really understand the anatomy of it, but basically, like, at the moment, at that point, I was pumping oxygenated blood around his body. So basically, when he was born, that valve was shut and he would turn blue, suffocate and die. Obviously, that was also not an option I was willing to entertain. And then the third option, and I think it's significant that it was presented to me as the third option, was, well, there is the potential to do some surgery. I was like, great, well, we'll do the surgery. And she explained it's a series of three open heart surgeries. But the way she was talking about it, like, I was like, this is my green light. This is our silver lining. And that is just not how it was pitched to us.
Is it expensive, or because it's the chances of survival at the end of it are still minimal?
Yeah, the chances are really minimal. So there's three open, so for hypoplastic left heart syndrome, there's three open heart surgeries. And the chance, the
following,
first one is,
sorry, follow, and that involves carrying your baby to term, giving birth, and then whisked straight off straight away, is it?
So the first one is in the first couple of days that they're born. They have the first heart surgery. The second one is at some, I can't remember the exact details, but the second one is within the first year. And then the third one is within the kind of second or third year. At each point in this, at each kind of surgery, she said to me the chances of survival, and this was obviously 2015, so it might have moved by now, but at that point, chance of survival for each surgery is a third. So a third of babies make it for the first surgery, and then of those, a third make it for the second, and so on and so forth. So it's really slim.
Wow.
And they just don't really, they don't like to do it. And I think also the thing she pointed out as well was, particularly with HLHS, these surgeries, they're never going to cure, they can't cure the heart. So the only way to cure it is to have a heart transplant. And at that point, again, you know, baby children don't get heart transplants. I think, you know, we obviously went away and did so much reading. I think I completed the internet on HLHS, every single story of every family, every blog, everything. We ran the British Heart Foundation. We had so much kind of support. And the issue is that it can never be fully fixed. So you're kind of like, you're putting like a little shunt in there, and there's all various things to try and basically get the heart to go to work well enough, but it was never going to fully work. And at that point, again, the oldest survivor of HLHS, or the oldest young person living with it, was in their late teens. So they were like, well, we just don't know, you know, how long. And the cardiac nurse who was sat with us, you know, with her hand on my knee, she said, oh, I work in fetal cardiology and in neonatal cardiology. And the way the story, you know, we spoke to her a few times, we had her number, we could call her. And I remember her ringing her and saying, tell me what to do. And she's like, I can't tell you what to do. She said, but I can tell you that I'm a mother of three and I work on this ward and I work with these children, these babies every day. And she's like, and I wouldn't put a child through. Mm. And her saying that, you know, we had many conversations with our local hospital, with the fetal team there, you know, but it was her saying that to me that was the thing that kind of ended up sort of sitting with me.
Give you permission to say, okay.
Yeah.
Because to make that decision yourself is just probably what the worst decision that anyone ever has to make, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's been some lows in my 31 years, but the lowest point of my whole life where I felt just the most broken was you have to sign a bit of paper. So you have to sign the form to say that you consent to have the procedure, which then begins the termination. And I had to, because it's my body, I had to sign it. And that was, it took me a long time to put my pen to paper. Even when, you know, my husband and I, we kind of reached the decision together. I can't say it was the right one. I can't ever say like it felt right, because how can it feel right? But it felt like the only option. Mm. And I had to really sit with like, why are we doing it? Are we doing it for ourselves? Because a lot of the evidence was like, you know, think about your life, think about, and I was like, is this about us or is this about our baby? And it was when that nurse said to me, I wouldn't put a child through it, that I was like, well, it's not, because I wanted to be that mum. I wanted to be that, you know, the kind of great, almost cute mum, the superhero mum who you hear about, who's like there, you know, and my family and friends were saying, you know, it's going to be awful. You'll be living at Great Ormond Street. You won't see your husband. I don't know how you're going to afford it. And I was like, I don't care. None of that stuff matters. I want to be this lioness mum and take on the world. But there was, you know, I feel like we did the best we could for our baby based on the evidence that we had.
Yeah.
But I can't say if it was right, because how can I ever, I don't know how I ever get to a point where I can say it was the right thing. It was the thing.
It's so interesting because we spoke recently to Lucy. Is this ringing a bell with you, Laura?
Yeah.
Laura B. Oh yeah, sorry. You're both called Laura B. because she said exactly what you've just said. She made a similar decision and had this, a similar difficulty, you know, with what you've just explained. And she said, we all said, you know, this is an expression that I love, you know, we do the best we can with the information that we have at the time.
Yeah.
And what she did was her and her husband wrote to their future selves at that point to remind them why they had done, why they come to that decision, what was behind that decision. And I thought that was actually really powerful in doing that. Is that something that you would perhaps recommend that other people do if they were in that position?
100%. So I never wrote to myself, but the day we got back from the hospital, we signed the documentation. I scribbled on the back of a postcard a little letter to our as then unnamed unborn child, and it was that scribbling on a postcard that then eventually became my first little blog and my little Instagram share. Postcard to Finley, and that's why it was called Postcards to Finley, because it clicked on the back of a postcard. And I just wrote that down, and I remember writing like, "It's for you. I promise, it's for you." And then I had a journal, and I wrote in that journal every single day, sometimes two or three times a day. And I did that for 372 days from the day we came home from hospital without him, you know, until over a year later. And so in that, they were written, some of it was written to me, some of it was written to him, some of it was written to, you know, it's all a series of sort of letters. Some of it was kind of just rambling. Some of it was like, you know, but it was, I've still got all those journals. And there's something that I was sort of intermittently sort of pick up and pick down, particularly sort of now where I'm at in my kind of healing, mental health, whatever, I have returned to those, and kind of I really needed to read that, because there were times, particularly in the last 18 months, when I've been quite unwell, when I forgot that. And I think it's easy to kind of other things take over. And I'm really glad that I had a written record, because I can't, you know, you, when it comes to trauma, you can't trust your own memory, you can't trust your own judgment on things. So having a written document, that document from the time. And obviously, you know, in there, I do talk about the fact that there were days when I absolutely doubted that. And was it the right thing? Was it wrong? But having that kind of seeing that written down and seeing that kind of process and that, you know, the thought, that sort of stream of consciousness, it was a lifesaver for me, particularly sort of where I'm at now with trauma and with everything. So, yeah, you know, if you can, jot it something, even if it's just on a postcard, just jot something down.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that. So what happened after you signed those papers?
So at this point, I was 24. I was 24 weeks pregnant, which is significant, because had he been born 3 days before he was born, he wouldn't have been registered as stillborn because of the viability. So for us, we, you know, it was sort of about 10 days from that appointment at Great Ormond Street to actually reaching a decision. It was about 10 days, which felt like forever, but also no time at all. But I think once we kind of settled with what we were going to do, we were like, we just need to do it. I was getting more and more pregnant. But as weeks went on, everyone was starting to know I was pregnant. And I think once I knew what was going to happen, so we went and we signed the papers, and they gave me, it was a standard induction process was going to happen. So they talked about the procedure. So the worst word in the English language, I think, is foeticide. And that is the name of the procedure. So what happens when you go for a termination at that gestation is they have to ensure that the baby won't be born alive. Because of the, you know, you obviously decided to not continue the pregnancy. So I signed the papers and I was scheduled to come in the next day for the procedure. And I went in the next day, and I remember it was it was the day that Djokovic won Wimbledon. Because I remember coming home from hospital and I was in physical pain and obviously emotional agony. And I remember lying on my sofa and watching Djokovic win Wimbledon. Anyway, so the procedure itself, so it's, you know, it's not nice.
Trigger warning. Over the next 30 seconds or so, Laura describes the foeticide procedure. So skip forward to about 19 minutes if you want to miss that.
It's not nice, but it's just very similar to an amniocentesis, basically. So a big needle goes in, free belly, and I've still got the scar. And they inject like a toxin straight into the baby's heart to stop their heartbeat. So that happened. And there were two obstetricians. There had to be two obstetricians in there, kind of like legal reasons. My husband was in there. They turned the screen away. So I went in and he was wiggling and kicking around and he's moving on the screen. And they turned the screen away. He went in and then just turned the screen off. And they just said, "I'm really sorry." And then they give you like a sort of typical induction process. They give you the medic. I don't know what it's called, but they give you the medication, you know, to kind of sort of get labour started. I was obviously very early. So before I went in for my actual induction, which is going to be 3 days later, they gave you, it was some sort of tablet to sort of start softening the cervix. Went home, barely slept, cried. And then 3 days later, I went in for an induction. like a standard induction procedure. And yeah, he was born on the 6th of July. So
did you know before he was born that he was a he?
So we didn't. And then when we knew what was going to happen, I did ask, like, can you just tell me the gender of my baby? And the obstetrician, it wasn't the particular appointment with the procedure, but it's the one before when we had another scan. So can you please just tell me? And they said, we think it's a boy, but we can't be sure because he'd like the position he was in. So we kind of thought he was a boy. So in those 3 days, we kind of talked about potential names for him. The reason we chose Finley was because the name Finley means small soldier.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. And so, well, Finley Eric. So Finley means fair-haired warrior, and Eric is small soldier. So Finley Eric. Eric is a family name for both of us. So, yeah, so we kind of talked about names. There was this weird moment when we had already talked about names before, when we were first pregnant, we were kind of excited. And I used to teach, so I was around kids all the time. So there's a certain names you veto straight away because they're like, you know, either, I mean, I'm as same as you, Laura. I was one of about 50 Lauras in my school, so I didn't want a really common name. And Finley was a name that was really popular. We have it the Scottish spelling, but the other spelling was really popular. So I remember in our first talks about names before, you know, anything was even wrong, we said about Finley, I was like, oh, but he'll be one of like hundreds of Finleys, which is not a problem, but being one of many Lauras. But then we decided that obviously as he was never going to be, his name was never going to be called in a register. So it really didn't matter, you know, if he was going to be one of 100. So yeah, we named him Finley. It was just not what you expect, is it, from your first
so brutal as well. It's the whole way it happened, like I was welling up, which, well, I couldn't say anything, but that whole kind of
it's okay. I think the thing for me was that, like, I know a lot of people will say that they had no idea that babies could die, and it was this massive shock. That actually wasn't the case for me. 3 years before I fell pregnant, my first friend to get pregnant, the first one, her son Oliver was stillborn at 33 weeks. So I was 21 years old, my first friend to have a baby, and her baby died. That was completely shocking to me. I had no idea that babies died. And when it happened to her, so I think when I was pregnant, I was aware that babies could die. But I didn't think it was going to happen to me, and not in an arrogant way, but I always remember when my friend Emma, who's Oliver's mum, she came to see me. She was obviously an amazing support to me when Finley died. I remember that the thing that she said to me was, she said when Oliver died, she was obviously, it was devastating. She said, but I kind of felt like I'd taken one for the team. She said, you know, I felt like because it happened to me, that nobody in my life, none of my friends or family would ever, ever have to go through this because I'd gone through it. And so she, you know, and again, I mean, I think we must be one of the most unlucky friendship groups, because when she said that to me, I couldn't understand what she meant. I was like, how could you think that about your grief? How could, but then in 2020, another friend from that same friendship group, her son was diagnosed with a fatal condition. She had to have a termination, and I found myself saying those same words to her.
So did you find that when that happened, you were able to kind of step up and be there for each other in terms of what, letting her know what to expect? And
yeah, and I think so her diagnosis was quite a bit later, so her son was a bit bigger, so the kind of labor process was, I mean, labor's labor, isn't it, to be honest. But yeah, we were. And I think, because I didn't really talk about the name, you know, probably as you guys know, like when I got in the gang, I then kind of really came in the online gang in the Insta world, and I was talking about Finley, but I didn't ever really talk about the details behind his death. Because obviously now it's not the case, but then kind of 2015, 16, people weren't really talking about termination. It's stillbirth, miscarriage was all still very taboo, but there was a sort of growing community online, but TFMR was like the taboo within the taboo, like nobody spoke about it. Yeah. And I felt, even within that really safe community of the baby loss world, I didn't feel like I could talk about it. And so when Finley died, my friend Emma, I didn't feel like I could tell her the exact detail. Like, I told her that he was ill, and I told her that he died. And actually she said she figured it out, but I never actually said, because I didn't know if I could. So by the time it came to our other friend whose son died, just over a year ago, you know, by that point I had been much more open about the story of Pam Finley's death. I think the landscape's kind of shifted, and people are talking more openly about ranges of losses. So I was able to talk to her about it, and able to tell her as much or as little she wanted to know. And I think for her, and I don't want to speak for her, but from what she said, hearing me talk about Finley and you know, she's like, I don't judge you at all for what you did. I see it as an, I mean, there's some people sort of talk about TFMR as like compassionate induction. And yeah. She said, like, I see how much you love your son, and I see how much you, how much he's still such a part of your life. This was 4 years on. So she said that kind of gave her strength to know that she knew what she was doing was the right thing, but to kind of know that she was then going to be okay with that and she could live with that.
Which is amazing, isn't it? Knowing people that have been through it and have survived it, because at the time you don't feel like you're going to survive it.
No, you don't. And I remember, like, you just don't, you don't know how you can, how you're ever going to live, how you're ever going to get through. And I think, you know, baby loss is always devastating and there's no hierarchy of grief. But for me, there was just, and I think everybody feels guilty when they experience a loss, no matter what point or what the circumstances are. But I had a bit of paper that said it was my fault, or that said it was on me, that said that I've made that decision. I could pinpoint the exact, you know. And interestingly, when I then became really poorly with my breakdown, my memory, I was quite psychotic. So my memory of this is hazy, but apparently I was saying to the hospital staff, like, do you know what I did? Do you know what I did? I'd killed my baby. Because in my head, in my kind of psychotic moment, all I could see, and I don't remember this, but all was that bit of paper. And it was like a, it was like a sentence to me, like in, you know, in trauma. That's not how I see it now, but that's kind of how it came up for me as this, like a death sentence that I'd signed, like a warrant. Which of course that's not what it is at all. But you know.
I mean, obviously being quite vocal about your experience, have you come up against any criticism?
No, actually I haven't. And I was really scared. So I also wasn't really sure about ever sharing. And I remember just after my daughter was born in 2018, it was when Elle, Feathering the Empty Nest, launched her Mum's Voice series. And she, I mean, we'd kind of been speaking for a couple of years ever since Teddy died. And so we, you know, kind of spoke regularly online. And she messaged me and said, I'm going to do this blog series and I'd love you to share something. And I was like, oh, that's amazing. Thank you. You know, we kind of met at the Tommy's Awards and things. And so she was like, I'd love you to share a piece. I remember thinking, I was like, this is kind of now or never. Like, if I don't say now, I'll never say, because obviously Elle, you know, the platform that she has and her kind of voice within the baby loss community, I was like, this is a real opportunity. And if I can take it or I can't, but if I don't take it now, I'll probably never say. So I messaged her and was like, listen, this is the story. What do you think? And she was like, share it. Like, she's like, Laura, I cannot tell you how many people message me with that story and they don't, and they feel so unseen. And so when I did that, it was terrifying. I was so scared. But the response was overwhelmingly positive. I do have quite a lot of people who follow me through Instagram who have children with HLHS, children who are babies who maybe they didn't get a diagnosis until they were born. So obviously, you know, they were then confronted with that diagnosis at post-birth. So, you know, ending the pregnancy wasn't an option. Or people who knew about the diagnosis and chose to continue and kind of go for the surgery options. And they were the people that I was most afraid of, because I was thinking, you know, how might I be judged? Might, you know, and know that people I've spoken to.
You try to be sort of like a voice for people. And of course, you can't be a voice for everybody because you've not been through the same experience as everybody else. But it is a worry, like, that you're not representing everyone as well as they want to be represented. But it's a tricky thing. It's a fine line, because, like I say, we haven't been through, we've been through lots of different types of baby loss between us, but we've not been through everything. But we still sort of act as a bit of a voice for the community. So it's just trying to do our best by people.
And I think, you know, I have had perhaps to my detriment, is I'm quite open online, and I think I don't have a particularly big following, but it's quite a engaged following. And whenever I have, I always, not always, but I often have things where I can ask me anything and people ask questions that are a little bit close to the line. I've had people outrightly ask me, do you regret your decision? Do you think it was the right thing? How do you feel about, you know, and they're very direct, and they can be quite painful. But I just try and think that comes from a place of curiosity, perhaps, from them. It comes from, you know, maybe a lack of compassion, because they maybe don't understand what they, you know, they're not really, I don't think it's set out to hurt. And if they do, I mean, maybe it is sometimes a bit trolley, but I've not really had anything negative. I think people just haven't bothered to be unkind or to be cruel about it. I don't have any regrets about sharing the full story behind Finley's life and death. And I think, you know, since, like, now there are many more people adding their voice online. And it's really great to see. It took me 3 years to be able to do it. I couldn't do it in the immediate aftermath.
And you'd already had your other children by the time you opened up about it. Yeah, it's the same for me. There's a lot of people who go through baby loss and don't have living children who feel like a little bit of, I don't know, is it resentment? It's difficult for them to hear people who've got the happy ending.
Yeah.
But I don't know about you, but for me, I just didn't have the strength to be able to do it before that. And I wish I had have done. And I think it's amazing that there are so many people now who are openly sharing their stories when they haven't got their happy ending yet. That's really brave, but I wasn't brave enough. Maybe because there wasn't as much of a community to feel sort of held and supported while doing it. But I think it's really great that people can do it now.
I don't necessarily think it's bravery, though. I think that's what you perhaps see it as. But I think, like, if you're not in the right headspace, you're not in the right headspace. It's not. If you are, that's brilliant. As you say, those voices are fantastic for people that are looking for them. But I wouldn't necessarily say you weren't brave enough to do it while you were still trying. I would say that your headspace was not, you were so occupied by the desire to get pregnant that you didn't have that space.
Yeah, but I do think that the lack of other voices doing the same thing meant that I didn't feel, I feel like I didn't feel brave enough. Like that, if there'd have been more people speaking about it, I might have said, me too. But that's why it's great that there's such a good community now that's doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't have a crystal ball, but, 5 years after my son died, I was in a psychiatric hospital. And I do wonder, obviously I've done a lot of work around kind of the reasons I was there and, it's an ongoing process, but I do think that maybe in 2015, it felt very, very lonely. Mm. In a way that I would hope it doesn't feel quite so lonely now. Obviously, the experience of losing a child, losing a pregnancy is isolating, but there is a lot of people feeling that. And I think that voice is getting louder. And I feel really privileged to have sort of been kind of bearing witness to that. I mean, the kind of the big sort of cohort for me of people sharing their voices, people like Elle, people like Michelle, the Legacy of Leo, all the people I was on maternity leave with Leo when they were speaking out and sharing, and that felt like, I thought, oh my, how amazing, these warrior women. Like I didn't have that, but I felt like I still gained so much from them, even though I was kind of, in terms of my journey, not really a word I like, but I was a kind of, I had my rainbow, but still I saw such strength and comfort from their words. Jess and Nat from Legacy of Leo, they came to see me when I was in hospital. They drove all the way to Norfolk, which is no small feat, given how far away it is. And they came and they put flowers on Finley's grave for me because I was obviously banged up. And they came to see me in hospital. And that just shows what an incredibly compassionate and devoted and understanding community it is, that people who I've met them a handful of times in real life, but they made that drive and they did that because they knew they cared. And that was just amazing. I mean, I remember Jess saying to me, she said, you're paving the way, Laura. You're the first of many who were going to go batshit crazy after the baby dies. So do not worry about that. But I think it just shows, how amazing that community is and how powerful finding other voices and finding people. And that's what, this podcast online, that's what's so great about it. Because, years ago, that wouldn't have been an option.
Mm. And tell us a bit about your batshit crazy.
That's the end of part one. Tune in next week for all the batshit crazy stuff.
Thank you so much, everyone, for tuning in. And please, please, when you have a second, rate us, review us, and share us. And let's get this taboo smashed. See you next week.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the ageing process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.